Hey, good morning. My name is Corey. I'm on the pastoral staff here at Hope. I get a chance to open up God's Word with you this morning. To those who are worshiping over at Hope East, hello. We broadcast the sermon between buildings at the 9 a.m. service, and so if you're over there, hello to you. Some people are maybe a little bit more inclined to find where's the preacher preaching live. I'll give you this nugget of a reality. Those that sit in the broadcast site, and it switches between places, but those who switch and they follow the broadcast, and you're viewing me on a screen, you have this benefit, is there's a five-minute delay. And I've been told by our technical people that they actually bleep out all of the heresy. And so at the live venue, you don't get that. You don't get that benefit. And so I've had people come to me afterwards at the broadcast site and just say, hey, what did you talk about? We heard you read the Bible, and then it was just one giant bleep the rest of the service. And so what did you actually say? Hopefully that's not true. Hopefully that's not reality. We had a great time over the past 10 days. We returned from a trip down to Florida. Jill's parents have spent the entire month of February down there, and they were hospitable and gracious, as they always are, and said, come on down. If you can figure out a way to get here, we will house you, and we will have a great time exploring southern Florida. So they're in Fort Myers. They're still in Fort Myers, going to be making their way back, but we had a chance to spend 9-10 days down there. We went to Fort Myers for a little bit, then we drove up to Orlando, and then we returned to Fort Myers. But while in Orlando, we had the opportunity to go to Universal Studios. For those who have been there and have seen those two parks, they have this special attraction related to Harry Potter. And the intelligence of Universal Studios says, we're not going to put all of this stuff at one of our parks. We'll separate it, put it at both parks, so all of our visitors feel obligated to go both parks. And I was fascinated by the level of detail. This was true 3 years ago when we went through all the Disney parks, but here as well, all the time and attention given to detail. And my boys were excited about the rides, excited about the attractions, and I'm wanting to look at a window and just like, they made this to look weathered. Like, they painted this in such a way as to not just appear like old, but also like there's some green moss and algae. I just wanted to look at a window. And my boys were like, on with it, Dad. And so there's the castle, phenomenal. Got to go through there and see all the sights. I mean, just waiting in line is an experience with this. You go into a room and there's all these pictures on the wall, and they're talking to one another, and they're asking why the Muggles are there. And then you go into this other room and see other things. And so this was Hagrid's hut by the side of one of the roller coasters there. Going through the escape from Gringotts, got to talk to this guy for a little bit. He wanted to know about my future financial investments and what business I had going on there. And I don't often do this. If those that know me know, I'm kind of a black sheep on our staff and elder team, because I don't occasionally drink a beer, well, really ever drink a beer. That makes me the black sheep. Imagine that on our elder team. But I was on vacation, so I thought, what the heck? And I grabbed a butter beer and drank that, which this is a Harry Potter thing, if you don't know. And it's like a cream soda float. You know, it's not a root beer float. It's like a cream soda float. But that was phenomenal because there was a lot of sugar in it, and that's kind of my love language there. And continuing forward, just amazing the level of detail. We went into Ollivander's. Are there anybody read these? You guys know what this is? Okay, some of you. Okay. Maybe too many of you. No. Okay, so we went into Ollivander's, and there's a well-known phrase within this series of books and movies that the wand chooses the wizard. And interestingly enough, we spent maybe 15, 20 minutes walking around there, and dishearteningly, no wand chose either of our young wizards. And so I think that says something about us. But I don't know, Jill and I threw some money down, and amazingly, a wand chose us after we threw down some money. And so we had to go test that baby out. And you go around the park, and there's these different spots where you can basically stand on this and it tells you how to move the wand, and so you do it and then things happen. For example, there was one where, not on the main level, but a second and third floor was full of just lights, like you imagine a lighting store, or that section of Menards just lit up. And you do this little thing and sure enough, it all lights up. There was one time I was standing and all of a sudden, yeah, I felt on the back of my leg, I'm wearing shorts, beautiful weather down there, I feel all of a sudden this wetness on the back of my legs. And somebody had done something that caused rain to happen, like right behind me. And thankfully, I was just beyond the blast radius of this rain here. But this is me, and I'm, casting a spell, and it's a fireworks store, and so all this stuff is going to happen. If you have a strong aversion to just the idea of sorcery and me talking about it in the church, that's me holding a plastic thing, pointing at a camera, causing some mechanical things to happen. Actually, you know what? That's not even me. That was just some guy that... So, yeah, no sorcery, none of that. It's all fictitious, fake, it's Universal Studios. Anyways, this has relevance to today's message, or I'll make it have relevance. I need to somehow write off this trip, and so no, we won't do that, We're gonna talk a little bit about money today, and I'm telling you, I have some comments about the money that's spent at these places, but maybe not in the way that you think. I am interested and fascinated by both Disney and Universal and how they create an experience and how that all goes together. And yes, money is a part of it. And the reality is, as Christians and as we're part of church and different ministries beyond this, money's a part of it. It's not the point, but it's a part of it. And Jesus recognizes that. And so throughout his gospel ministry, he talks about money. And so just be at ease. There's no guilt trip coming. There's no setup. I'm not going to, you know, kind of set you up and then hit you with the whammy. But Jesus talks about it. We're going to talk about it, okay? And we're going to do so within Luke's gospel. We're just continuing through. If you're new with us, this is our 66th message here. We're in chapter 16 today. We're going to talk about serving two masters. And Jesus is going to hold up two masters, God and money, and say, you can't serve both. You can't serve both. And so let me read through the passage, and then we're going to spend some time talking about it. But I want to land by just asking you humbly to consider this. To consider this possibility that there could be in you something that gives itself to money, to materialism, to greed. Okay? I just want to open up that as a possibility. As we live in one of the wealthiest nations on planet Earth, and as money is all around us and part of our culture and part of the system, okay? Ultimately, Jesus is saying that's not the point, but yet we do have to figure out our relationship to money. So let me read through this. Jesus told his disciples, there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. So he called him in and asked him, what is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management, because you cannot be my manager any longer. The manager said to himself, what shall I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me in to their houses. So he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, how much do you owe my master? 900 gallons of olive oil, he replied. The manager told him, take your bill, sit down quickly, and make it 450. Then he asked the second, and how much do you owe? 1,000 bushels of wheat, he replied. He told him, take your bill and make it 800. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly. For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. I tell you, use worldly wealth to gain friends for yourselves, so that when it is gone, you will be welcomed into eternal dwellings. Whoever can be trusted with very little can also be trusted with much. And whoever is dishonest with very little will also be dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches? And if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, who will give you property of your own? No one can serve two masters, Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. The Pharisees, who loved money, heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. He said to them, "You are the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of others, but God knows your hearts. What people value highly is detestable in God's sight." So in just reading it through there, okay, I had four slides, and it really breaks down into separating this passage into two halves, okay? The first would be the first two slides. The second half would be the second two slides, the third and fourth slide, okay? The first one deals with a parable, a story, this story of a shrewd manager, and then it gives way to some more explicit teaching that Jesus is going to share. The first half of this message deals with this parable, this story of the shrewd, or some of your Bibles might have a little title that says the dishonest manager, okay? We're gonna walk through that. It is the most difficult part of this passage. How do we understand this story, this fictitious account? What is Jesus trying to communicate with it? It's very difficult. There's much disagreement about who the master stands for, who the manager stands for, what is Jesus trying to get at as he articulates the behavior of the manager, and then the rich man commending the dishonest manager. Okay, so there's a lot of questions, a lot of confusion. I studied this passage early in the week with Aaron Shaw, one of our LDI interns. We had a lot of questions. I talked with Tim Johnson about kind of his perspective and what he thinks about this and some of the people's he's read. And then I also talked to Pastor Steve. What do you think? Who are you reading about this? And honestly, I've probably looked at 10 to 12 different opinions about how to read the first half of this passage. Some of you are really excited for me to get into that. Others of you are like, can you just bypass that and get to what we really know, second half of the passage? So I want to walk through this, but I think it's also just helpful for you to know right now where I'm at. I view this passage a little bit differently than Steve and Tim. Okay, and I'm going to try to highlight kind of the way they're kind of seeing some of these things and the commentators that they're reading versus how I might be reading it. But it's okay for you guys to know that the pastors can read the Bible, work hard to understand the text, and get done after a week's time and still kind of scratch our heads going, well, that's a tough one. I don't really know. Like, we actually feel like it's healthy for you to know that as a church. We want you to know that we wrestle with these things. We struggle through this, that you might read through your Bible and go, I don't get it. It's like, so that happens to us too. Like, that's okay. You don't have to have all the answers. I don't have to have all the answers. At the end of the passage, Steve, me, Tim, other commentators, we're going to get to the solid footing that we all believe in of can't serve two masters. Okay, we're going to get there. Let me just walk through this passage while recognizing there are some challenges that commentators disagree. It's not just that they disagree about the contents, they actually disagree about just this parable and how easy or hard it is. One commentator this week said this about the parable of the shrewd manager. Few passages of scripture have caused as much confusion as the opening parable, as the parable of the shrewd manager. I go to another commentator and he says this, the parable is straightforward. It's easy, it's very plain, easy to understand, you know, insinuating, what's wrong with you guys that can't figure this out? It's like, okay, you even disagree about how easy or hard this passage is. Excellent. All right, well, let's jump in here. I wanna just walk through this, and you can see in the insert in your notes that I'm asking these questions, and I'm going to highlight both sides of it, and I'll explain what that means in a little bit. So looking back at verse 1 here, Jesus told his disciples, there was a rich man whose manager was accused of wasting his possessions. The question is, who does the rich man represent? Okay, parables tend to tell stories about realities and truths, and so should we hold that this rich man is God or Christ or just kind of the divine figure here? Should we see the rich man favorably, or should we see the rich man in an unfavorable fashion? In a disfavorable viewpoint. Which of those two? And I'm going to leave that a little bit open-ended because we're going to walk forward. You're going to see some of the tension build, especially when the rich man commends the shrewdness, the dishonesty? No, shrewdness of this manager. So some would hold that this is God, rich. Why? Because God has everything, owns everything. So he's at play here, and it's given weight by the fact that This wasting is similar to the wasting and squandering by the younger son of last week's message. If you were here for that, the parable of the two brothers, the younger son squanders. He wastes the father's possessions and so on. And you can remember this slide from last week. Steve talked about Jesus having similarity to the good shepherd and to the woman and the father. That's kind of the Christ-like figure in those parables. And so by extension, kind of looking through that same filter, the rich man would be viewed as God. I'm looking at some of the behavior of the rich man, and I kind of have some concerns about viewing him favorably, where a Trike or a Tim or some of their commentators would see this person as being this rich man being the godlike figure. I would tend to have a little bit less favorable opinion of the rich man. Luke also will use rich man negatively at different points. And so just keep that in mind. Those are kind of the both sides there. We're going to keep walking forward, though, continue to tease out some of the tension. But this is tough stuff, okay? So it says, the rich man called him in and asked the manager, "What is this I hear about you? Give an account of your management because you cannot be manager any longer." Basically, it's like, clean out your desk. Okay, if that's the case, if this person's fired, why would they still get to do some financial dealings? I think that's one of the questions, right? This is a different day and age than what we live in. It's not just so easy as like, no. All of your accounts, your online accounts are now sealed. You're not able to access them, okay? This is a different day and age. It's like this person may have been separated from the master, and so there's going to be time for him to return and hand in quill and scroll of all the accounts, right? And so there's this time period where he's able to continue some financial dealing still. And so hand out your books. Your job is over. And that's kind of, the question then becomes, who does the rich man represent? Is it God? Is it not? Well, we're going to keep moving in our passage here. Verse 3, the manager says to himself, okay, so this is kind of like an internal thought bubble that Jesus gives us access to because it's a fictitious story. The manager said to himself, "What shall I do? What am I going to do now? I'm going to lose my job. My master is taking away my job. I'm not strong enough to dig, and I'm ashamed to beg. I know what I'll do so that when I lose my job here, people will welcome me into their houses." Okay? Who is the shrewd manager represent? Okay? Should we be looking upon this person favorably throughout the passage in a positive light? Because shrewd can mean prudent, can mean wise. So should we have a favorable disposition towards this manager or an unfavorable? Because shrewd can also mean self-preservation, self-focused, looking out for their own interests, which tends to have a little bit more negative connotation. But again, how you read this can cause you to go back and forth, okay? I'm trying to paint a little bit of both sides here of how to walk through this passage. What shall I do now? My master is taking away my job. I'm going to lose my job. I'm going to take some corrective actions now to help me in the future. Now, here's something that we need to know. Background of the system. And this is a great picture that I got from one of the commentaries this week. Just looking at the relationship among classes within an agrarian society. Where do people kind of divvy up from a worldly perspective? Who gets put in what place socially? And this is a helpful picture, okay? I'm going to enlarge it a little bit, but what we need to know is the ruler, chief ruler at the top, and then a bunch of governing class rulers below them, kind of, and then it gets us down to that weird-looking shape, diamond, hexa, hepta, that other thing, to the bigger part. Let me zoom in on that a little bit. So what we have is kind of a governing class underneath the ruler. They're going to be kind of near the top. We also have merchants, depending on how great a business person you are. You'll be a little bit on the left side there. You can see you might be close down to some peasants. Some peasants might be living larger than you are. If you're a poor merchant, if you're doing really well, you might be higher. And then we have this unique group called retainers and priests. Priests, religious leaders, okay? Pharisees, disciples. Synagogue, that's going to be that group of people, right? And so there's a certain privilege and a certain honor that comes from being a part of that. Retainer would be what? A manager? Somebody who's exercising authority on behalf of somebody who has power, who has means, who has land, okay? So I'd put the manager the Pharisees, soon to be the disciples, kind of in that group. And then you have other groups, peasants, interestingly, artisans, the artists in the church here. If you graduated with that degree and you feel like you're living lower than just normal class life, it's hard. It was hard back then, hard now to do art, okay? So that's depicted here. But then look at the bottom two. Unclean, right? Unclean, degraded. And then even lower, expendables. So we have that unique comment of the manager of like, no. I'm not strong enough to be a laborer. And I have too much pride to be a beggar. What is the manager getting at there? And I really appreciate the words that are shared in this commentary about this idea of what's he getting after? The social setting in Luke is one in which issues of social status and social stratification are paramount. Luke's social world was defined around power and privilege and is measured by a complex of phenomena. What goes into that? Well, religious purity, family heritage, land ownership for non-priests, vocation, ethnicity, gender, education, and age. Did you see that little parenthetical there? For non-priests, what does that mean? Priests didn't own land, okay? So land ownership was a big deal for other people. But priests, even going back to Old Testament, Levites, God commissioned them. You're not going to have land. You're going to live off the hospitality of other people, okay? But all of this, you put that all in a blender, and that kind of leads to your social status. Let's continue on here. For the manager, loss of position entails a forfeiture of social status with the consequence that initially the only options he can entertain are manual labor and begging. These locate him prospectively among the unclean and degraded or even expendable of society. So the manager senses this. I'm going to lose my social status. I'm going to lose the position that I have appreciated, a place of honor, a place of interacting with the elites of society. And if I lose this job, I risk becoming one of the lowest within the social class of our society. And so therefore, then, it leads into some choices and some behavior. Verse 5, so he called in each one of his master's debtors. He asked the first, how much do you owe my master? 900 gallons of olive oil. That's a lot of money, okay? We don't tend to do trading these days in gallons of oil. So I'm just telling you, a lot of money. Huge debt that this guy owed to the master, okay? Manager told him, take your bill, sit down quickly, cut it in half. Then he asked the second, how much do you owe? 1,000 bushels of wheat. He replied, take your bill and make it 800. Cuts it down by 20%. Now, how should we understand this behavior? This is really challenging within the parable, okay? Because you could view it very negatively and say, you're a thief. This is why you're losing your job, okay? To view it favorably and positively is to say, this person was already out of a job. They already risked losing their social status. So he did kind of this last-ditch effort of self-preservation, of being prudent, of being wise. He basically, in this action, throws himself down upon the mercy of the master. That's all he could do. That was his last-ditch effort. And it's possible with that kind of reading that you would look at this and say that 900 gallons, a lot of that would have come to the manager. Okay, they don't have like principal and interest and, hey, we're doing these dealings and so we're going to retain some. Basically, it was just all the master's money. It was his account. And then the managers had to kind of like say, no, this is what you owe my master. And his cut was in there. It was buried in there. But really, it was all belonged to the master and they would take their cut. And so it's possible that the master is seeing him do this and realize the manager is forfeiting his cut and giving me what is still due me. And so that's how you might view this favorably, these dealings, okay? Negatively would be like, dude, you're stealing. You're being dishonest. This is thieving. So that's again, trying to see it both ways and understand both sides of this, okay? Let's keep going. I'm still teasing out some of the tension here. The master commended the dishonest manager because he had acted shrewdly, okay? If this parable ends with the master basically saying, what gives? I fired you. And then before you could even get here, you gave up even more of my money. If that's how the parable ends, it makes it a lot easier for us. But this is maybe not the response we would have expected, which makes the parable overall very challenging, because the master commends the dishonest manager because he acted shrewdly. Now, a couple interesting notes here. Dishonest manager. He got that title now, not earlier. So the dishonesty comes because this is how the dealings were. This was dishonest. So then he gets commended not for his dishonesty, but for acting shrewdly, prudently, wisely. If you're viewing this passage overall with the rich man and the manager, their behavior being a positive example that Jesus wants to draw from, you're going to say the master realizes his manager had lost everything, and he did this last-ditch effort of just throwing himself down upon the mercy of the master. And the master says, wow, if you had had this kind of behavior early on, I would have never fired you. But you're acting shrewdly. You're acting wisely. You're trying to honor me in front of the people that owed me a ton of debt, and you release some of my profit or our profit to them. So they like the master now because he reduced the debt, but you took it out of your own cut. That was a shrewd move, and I commend you for it. Now, we don't know how this parable ends. We don't know if that's kind of what he's thinking or kind of the negative way of seeing this is the master and the dishonest manager are both worldly people looking at the bottom line, trying to figure out how to deal with people in a way that is self-seeking, self-preserving. So a rich man viewed negatively in this passage would basically look upon that dishonest manager and go, what the heck, you've been wasting my possessions, okay? I fired you. You do these business dealings after I've really fired you, but it preserves your social status even after I fired you. And a worldly person goes, wow, that was actually pretty good. That was actually pretty smart of you. You made some dealings here to preserve your social status. And so a person of the world, and again, I tend to view this rich man as an unfavorable position, but even he can commend that kind of dealing because he himself wants to deal in a way that is shrewd. Now, With all that said, and kind of seeing both sides of it, whether you're on the favorable side, rich man is a godlike figure, and this person's thrown himself down upon that mercy, or more unfavorable, where Jesus is going to say, this is how the world does it. We do it a little bit differently. Ultimately, though, we come to this verse, okay? For the people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind than are the people of the light. So let's ask the question of how should the rich man's commendation of the manager be understood. Ultimately, I want to land here just a little bit because it's a challenging deal. The people of this world would tend to be those outside of God and his kingdom. People of this world are all about the here, the now, the visible, the tangible, okay? And Jesus says they are shrewd. We see it in this passage. This manager was shrewd in his financial dealings. I would tend to say that for the people of this world are shrewd in dealing with their own kind. I would put the rich man in that same category. Others wouldn't. That would have a favorable disposition toward the master, okay? But I would put master and manager as people of the world. They are shrewd in dealing with their own kind. Jesus says that's not up for debate. People in the world know how to utilize money in such a way as to preserve their social status. How does that go? What does that look like? Well, in society, it tends to be that you will entertain, give time, give attention to those of same social status or above. Because in doing so, there's a benefit. There's a benefit of reciprocity that you give to them and they will be able in kind to return that. That you show hospitality to them and they can return that gift of hospitality. Or those above us in social status, that serving them, showing kindness to them, will win you favor that they can then bestow down upon you at some later time. The people of this world are more shrewd in dealing with their own kind, with one another, of similar social status or above, than the people of light are. And what is Jesus getting at here? He's drawing a comparison contrast that we're going to go into with the second half of our passage. But he wants the people of light, he wants the people that follow him and believe in him to learn something from this. But it's a lesson, I think, with just a little bit of an adjustment. Let me go back to Universal Studios. Let me go back to the CEO of Universal Parks and Resorts, Thomas Williams. Because I want to draw out this idea of a shrewd businessman. Because I think there is. If you're in business, you have to be wise. You have to take good care of your company. And a part of that is money. But if you make your endeavor about money, people will sniff it out. So what I've experienced this year and previously at Disney is they make it about the experience. They make it about the people that are coming into their park. And yes, they will make money. They will make a lot of money, okay? You don't slap down the amount of money I did for a wand or for a funnel cake. I didn't get a funnel cake this time around. Just occurs to me. I didn't go to Universal because I didn't get my funnel cake. What do you focus on? You focus on the experience. You focus on the people making memories. You focus on your workers, making them feel a part of something bigger than themselves, that they actually get kind of just immersed in their characters. They're not just people saying like, okay, line, move forward. No, it's like, no, I'm at Hogwarts, and I get to be a part of this thing, okay? So they make it special, even for their workers to feel like they're a part of this. And yes, money is just in and around all of this. But if he and his staff focus just on the money, it's not long before people start experiencing the negative side of that. And it'll be detrimental to people's experience, and then people won't want to go anymore. Ah, they're just out to get your money. So for him to be shrewd, to say, let's keep making it about others. Let's keep loving on our guests, giving them a great experience, okay? And we're going to take that idea, okay? I think that idea is in there in the parable, and that idea is true of Universal and Disney. How is Jesus now going to draw on that and say, how about you guys? Can we learn from them something? Because they're really shrewd in their dealings. Children of the light, children of the kingdom of God are not. And yet there's something I think we need to learn from Jesus and his teaching. So let's go there now. We're going to switch to the second half of this passage and look at what can we learn from this parable. I tell you. So that's where I feel like the parable's ending. Jesus is going to start teaching now. Why? Because he entered himself back into this very clearly. I'm going to tell you some things that I need you to hear. And then he says this, use worldly wealth. It's like, okay, I see that. Like the shrewd manager did that. Rich man's going to do that. We should do that. Literally, this is the mammon of unrighteousness. Okay, don't use that word mammon outside the church. Don't. Okay, because people know that's like, that's not an English word. That's not common. Like, what does that even mean? It simply means just wealth. It means property. It means possessions. So Jesus ultimately saying, yes, you're going to utilize money. You're going to use money. You're going to use your possessions. You're going to use your property. I don't care what the number is, okay? For some of you, you've been a part of churches where they really care about the number. How much you make, how much you save, how much you give, how much you invest, okay? And the numbers really matter. And how many zeros? It doesn't matter. This is for everybody, right? He says if it's true when you have little, it's true when you have a lot. So it doesn't matter where you're at on that spectrum of little to a lot. Use worldly wealth. Use money or possessions. What is this, possessions of unrighteousness? Just a way of saying just earthly. Just, this is a reality. It's an earthly currency. It's an earthly property. You have an earthly house. Okay, this idea of unrighteousness is just saying, I want to talk about true things. I want to talk about spiritual things. How do I communicate that I'm not right now? I'm talking about earthly things. Mammon of unrighteousness. That's the phrase just to communicate. We're talking about earthly possessions. So use those things to gain friends for yourselves. What does this mean? Well, if you take it like the shrewd manager, just at face value, then you would say, okay, well, to mimic the shrewd manager, I'm going to have my money and possessions and utilize them in such a way that I maintain my social status. And ultimately, I'm going to say, I don't think that is what Jesus would call us to do. I think what the shrewd manager does to maintain social status is what Jesus is going to say the Pharisees are doing. The Pharisees, religious leaders, representatives of God, are in their dealings, in their finances, in how people are tithing and giving to the synagogue. They're actually making those dealings about maintaining social status? And Jesus is going to say, use your possessions, use your money. Use your time. Use your talent. Use everything that you have to gain friends, to bring forth friendships. But it's not in order. The aim is not in order to maintain your social status. Not at all. Why? Because kingdom values are different than the world. And that's where I think the parable is helpful. But then we're going to leave that parable and get immersed in what does God want for us in that? Gain friends for yourself. Yes, be friendly. Share hospitality with one another. Open up your houses for one another. Be generous that friendships and relationships might happen. But not just to people alongside you and not just to people above you socially. Everybody. Ultimately, we see this from, let me jump into this quote from Wilcock. He says, although these settings, your property, ability, and time belong to this life only, that's that mammon of unrighteousness, okay? Yet, what will happen to you then when you pass into this next life will depend on what you are doing with them here and now. Make sure that your use of these things brings you into a fellowship of friends which will survive beyond death. That's where this passage kind of goes next. This idea of, all right, so that when it is gone, does when it is gone mean the wealth? No, it actually means just when this age ends. And that's a hard translation. You go to different English Bibles, they'll translate this differently. But when it is gone tends to just mean when this age ends. But in the Greek, it would just be like, when it ends. So it's like, when what ends? The wealthy. I think it's when this age ends, you will be welcomed into eternal dwelling. So end of the age, not when money is gone, leads to this idea that you'll be welcomed into eternal dwelling. Some of your translations, which ones? NASB and ESV will translate this line, they may receive you into the eternal dwellings. Wait, they, who's the they? Some would say this would be the people that you entertained with your hospitality. They're going to be there. Why? Because you use your possessions to bring forth kingdom values. As part of that, they believe in God and they'll be waiting there for you. A lot of people tend to see they, though, as God in reference, kind of a self-reference to God. And God will be there. God and his angels will be there to welcome you. Why? Because you have used your earthly possessions to show that you are not a person of this world. You're a person of a different world. You can be generous with all these things. Why? Because God's been giving you to you generously, and therefore you can have open hands with all your stuff. You can entertain those who have no ability to reciprocate and return that kindness. You can cross social status lines without an angle that you get something in return. That's not what you want. You just want to showcase the generosity of God, and you can. And as you do so, okay, when it is gone or when the time comes to an end, God will welcome you into your eternal home because you have showcased your faith by grace alone, through faith alone, through the cross alone, God welcomes you into his family, and you have showcased, I'm a part of the family of God. My eternity, my desire, my home is in heaven, not here, and so I don't need stuff. I can give stuff away. Kent Hughes says this, just who are these friends who will receive us into heaven? Many scholars think this refers to God himself because Jewish literature often referred to God in the divine plural, they, to avoid using the name of God, okay? So I want to move into this kind of serving two masters. I want to move from that parable a little bit less clear to some pretty straightforward, a little bit more plain in my mind, teaching of Jesus. And I just want to ask you, are you willing to just ask the question, God, is there any remnant of a love of money in my life? Not just that you have money. Because money's just a thing. It doesn't have favorable or disfavorable. It's just a thing. But our connection to money, our relationship emotionally, spiritually, has all sorts to do with your faith life. And I just want to ask, is there anything in that? Because I think the temptation I've had is just go, well, I know the right answer. And so when God says you can't serve both, I'm going to choose to serve God. And I'm going to make that declaration. And because I declared it, it's just true that I do serve God and not money. Like, that's how I've tended to relate to this passage. And I feel like as I read it with Aaron this week, you ever remember that sensation of having the wind knocked out of you? I felt like I had the spiritual equivalent of that happen this week. And it was nothing related to, oh my goodness, we've been having misdealings in our personal finances. I got to run home to my wife, and we got to, where we've been stealing, we need to steal no longer. It wasn't anything like that. It was like an emotional release. It was like this invisible, like unseen, people out there wouldn't know that it's happening, but just internally in me, I felt like there was a, like a wind that got knocked out of me of like, oh, I think I do have some sort of like emotional connection to money, where there's good things like money brings security to my family, and yet it can slip so easily beyond that to God, then that security can become insulation from the world and its challenges, and therefore I don't need faith because I have the security of money. There's something in that where it's such a slippery slope of earning, saving, tithing, investing that can so become, okay, then I don't need you, God. And I just felt that spiritual wind get knocked out of me this week of like, Cor, how are we viewing this? What are we understanding that? You know what the confession should be, but in your life, in your emotions, how are you doing? And so that's kind of the eye I want us to read these next few verses with. Whoever can be trusted with very little, college students, this passage has something to do with you. You can't just say like, well, no, later when I actually have a job and a steady income, then this passage will be about me. It's like, no. If you have a habit of being generous when you have nothing and very little, and just so you know, missionaries go overseas and they come back or bring some of their friends with them, and you know what their view is? We're all wealthy, okay? That's, no, you're American, so you're wealthy. That's the belief, okay? So you might think like, well, comparatively, I have less wealth. It's like, here it is. If you're trusted with very little, God will trust you with much. Are we talking still just physical stuff? This is where it switches a little bit, right? And whoever is dishonest with very little will be also dishonest with much. So if you have not been trustworthy in handling worldly wealth, physical stuff, earthly possessions, property, okay? That's just a baseline. Like, this is easy. It's visible. It's tangible. Okay, this is worldly stuff. It's temporary. We should all know our clothes on our body are rotting, right? The toys that we got really excited about a year ago are no longer, okay? Have my phone. It's just like, this is crap. It's 2 years old. It's crap, right? It goes so quickly through its lifespan and life cycle, right? We just replace things. We throw things away. If you've not been trustworthy with those things, just this worldly wealth, who will trust you with true riches, spiritual things? We can demonstrate our faith. True riches being in regard to spiritual things. We can demonstrate our faith in our engagement with the material world in a way that can honor God or show that we really care about our stuff. And it is that plain and that simple. James 2, you say you have faith. You claim to confess that you serve God, not money. And then he says, I will show you my faith by what I do. Doesn't negate that grace alone, faith alone, through Christ alone, that I am invited in the family of God, and you can demonstrate that you're a part of the family of God by showing this world, my possessions, I hold loosely to them. It's not ultimately what it's all about. It says, and if you have not been trustworthy with someone else's property, what is that getting at? It's all God's, right? It's all God's. Who will give you property of your own? Imagine if it were that I came into, the Hogwarts castle, and one of the employees was basically just saying, "Do you like what I built? Hey, you, this is mine. No, I work here. This is all my stuff." Or me as a participant came upon this and just like, "Oh, I love this park. It's so great." And then I go and I buy and I pretend like I'm a part of this and just start claiming it for my own. Yet, I think we're tempted to do that with our stuff. Like, well, I worked for it. I earned it. You did. And God is the owner of everything. And God gave you skills and intelligence and breath to do that. So I think he has something to do with it as well, you know? If you've not been trustworthy with someone else's stuff, God's stuff, who will give you property of your own? And then it comes to no one can serve two masters. Hear me carefully. I'm not saying money's bad. I'm not saying those of you who make much need to feel bad or guilty about that or are investing much. No. I'm talking about something deeper something invisible, something unseen, an emotional, spiritual connection to money that then dictates how you live in relation to other people. Use your money. Okay? Make money. Make a lot of money. Realize money doesn't make you. You cannot serve two masters. Either you will hate the one and love the other, or you will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve both God and money. I love how Martin Luther puts this, okay? We must use all these things upon earth in no other way than as a guest who travels through the land and comes to a hotel where he must lodge overnight. He takes only food and lodging from the host, and he says not that the property of the host belongs to him. He says not that. He doesn't say this hotel and everything belongs to me. Just so should we also treat our temporal possessions as if they were not ours and enjoy only so much of them as we need to nourish the body and then help our neighbors with the balance. Thus, the life of the Christian is only a lodging for the night, since we have here no continuing city, but must journey on to heaven where the Father is. I'm not trying to wrestle possessions out of your hand. I don't want your stuff. Hope doesn't want your stuff. I'm just saying how we engage the things that we have materially can communicate to a watching world our faith in God, can communicate to them. We hold loosely. We bring forth generosity that they might know the generosity of our Heavenly Father. Whoo, and here he goes straight after it. The Pharisees, who the Bible communicates, loved money, heard all this and were sneering at Jesus. He said to them, "You are the ones who justify yourselves in the eyes of others, but God knows your hearts. What people value highly is detestable in God's sight." God knows your hearts. Whatever money you're making or not making, God knows the heart. God knows the emotional connection you might have with your money and your possessions. God knows whether you're utilizing those to live with generosity to break down social classes or not. If you're doing that just like the manager, out of obligation, then they owe you and you owe them. And I just want to come back to that graph I had up earlier, because I think ultimately what Jesus is communicating to the people of his kingdom, regardless of what life circumstance you find yourself in, utilize your possessions, utilize your property as a way that demonstrates you are a servant to all. This is it. Sorry for the lack of Photoshop quality there. All believers basically get put under everybody else. If you want to make yourself first, what does he say? Make yourself last. If you want to become the greatest, what should you do? Become the servant of all. And then who's underneath believers? Jesus. Ran out of time. Didn't get to put Jesus up there. That's my mistake. Try not to make that happen again. Who serves us all? Who is the lead servant? Who came amongst us as one who serves? Not to be served, but to serve and give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus. Jesus related with those who are elite, those who are middle class, and also with the tax collectors and the sinners and the outcasts. A couple weeks ago, we talked about the banquet that Jesus held, breaking down lines across social classes, saying, "Everybody who will may come." May we be a people who break down social class lines, who give without expecting something in return. And in doing so, we mimic what Jesus has done for us. I had an example where I received this kind of generosity firsthand. It has to do with our trip to Universal. We want to be prudent with our personal finances. And so I'm like, hey, does anybody know of good hotel, you know, anything that would be inexpensive, anybody that had a good experience, you know, could you point us the same direction? We were looking for some connections, and I got this Facebook message. Okay, Core, saw your post on Facebook about Orlando in February. If you have specific dates, I can get you two free nights at the DoubleTree at the entrance to Universal. Let me know if you're interested. Happy to do it. Merry Christmas. I said, I'm interested. this get you two free nights. I understand that to mean like two free nights. Is that what your understanding of that message is? Just want to make sure we're talking the same language. Now, here's the deal. I don't know ultimately the motivation of this. I do know this person well enough to know if I put his name up there, he'd not be happy. I do know this person well enough to know that he's been generous this way over a course of the last 6 or 7 years. He has been generous to me personally, but also to our LDI leadership development program. To my recollection, I don't know that he's ever set foot in our church, maybe once, taken in a service, maybe a few times. So it's not like this core has been a great pastor to me and he's cared well for me. He's given good counsel. He's preached less heresy than the other guy. You know, like there's been none of that. So he's demonstrated generosity. And this just kind of total by surprise shares this with my family. And it puts us in a position where we're able to do some things that would be harder, much harder for us to do otherwise. And so, yes, I was happy to receive that. And I would guess that he's of means and I'm a little bit less. And just that he would serve top down, I guess, if you want to use that kind of language. He's a man of means. I would believe that. And so I just saw an example of just generosity and Christian living here that just so blessed me personally that I wanted to share that. And so I want to leave you with a couple questions here. What application does this have for us as a church? And maybe you're thinking, oh, here it comes. He set us up. You know, this is where he just bring the offering plates out one more time. Here's what our executive pastor says. Money's a sensitive topic. Our executive pastor and the other pastors, leaders here, we know that. The elders are sensitive to that. He says, we never want to be perceived as we're taking this opportunity to hook you into giving more here. If anything, and we're committed to giving financial updates to the church family, to the body. So if you're new with us, this is something we do quarterly, kind of give updates, where are we at financially? People want to know. He would say, hope is in a good place right now. Praise God. As we're right in line with where we hoped giving would be and even a little better. Hear that, okay? So there's not a bait and switch here. There's no sales tactic. If anything, I like that I'm giving this message when we're in a place of financial strength to say, it's not about the money. It's not about the money. It's about you and your faith and Jesus' words as he highlights his kingdom values. And then he says this, if hope is your home, we'd love for you to consider giving to participate in what God is doing here, which has some great, exciting things on the horizon. The possibility of multi-location. I think we're looking at, you know, if you're wondering where does hope's money go to, it goes to primarily staff. Yes, these buildings take some things to run, and yes, ministries have money that they need, but staff that we're trying to just continue to serve the body well, to equip the saints for the work of the ministry, that's where a lot of the tithes and offerings go. But even he says this passage has more to do with your heart, and so we want to talk about that, as that's why talking money is important. That's our executive pastor. And I love that that's his leadership is saying, yeah, I am the one that needs to make it balance. You know, I'm part of that at the end of all of this. But this is a hard issue. We want to talk about it because it's in your best interest to not let money wrap its way around your heart and squeeze out your spiritual life. Yes, you make money. Some of you make a lot of money, but it does not make you. It exists the potential to cause you to grow cold towards his gospel, cold towards his generosity. And that's where it comes to you. What application does this have in your life? I had the spiritual wind knocked out of me. There's an emotional thing that I think was happening internally that I want to be released from. I felt released from that this week. I want that for you. We're not anti-money. We are anti-love of money, where money consumes, where money becomes a master, and you start serving it rather than it serving you. Hope never wants to be a place where we start serving money. We want money to be a service to the people of hope, to the people beyond hope, that we might care effectively for our community. And so I would just have you ask the question, God, is there any way? I know my confession is, God, I want to love you and not money. Is there anything emotionally, anything unseen where maybe a line has been crossed, where maybe you've started to give into a connection emotionally, spiritually, that you've been looking at monies in ways differently than how God might have us? That's all I'm asking. No hard sale, just asking a question. I believe that if we can be free of the love of money, we will enjoy this life more than if we're gripped by that day in and day out and just, can I make a little bit more? Can I make a little bit more? Can I hold that out over others? You know, be free from that. Set your sights on heaven. Set your sights above. Let it be what it is. It's a resource. It's a thing. Let's pray together.